himself and rocked in time to the music. Not having caught the words in the first verse, he even decided that it was about either the people living in the metro or about the opposition to the Dark Ones, under whose onslaught his home station was soon supposed to fall. Then in one verse, he heard fascists, and Artyom understood it was about the battle of the Red Brigade fighters with the inhabitants of Pushkinskaya. When he tore himself away from his reflections, he discovered that the choir had fallen silent. Perhaps even Melnik himself didn't know the next verses.
"Guys, let's do combat, eh?"
the stalker was trying to persuade his fighters.
"A combat, my father, combat. You didn't hide your heart behind the guy's back."
He had only just started, but then he too fell silent. A stupor enveloped the party. The fighters began to unclench their hands and the circle disintegrated. Everyone was quiet, even Anton, who had been raving and muttering the whole time. Feeling a warm and turbid slush of indifference and fatigue filling the emptiness that had occurred in his head, Artyom tried to push it out, thinking about his mission, then telling himself nursery rhymes as he remembered them, then simply repeating, "I think you will not worm yourself into me." The fighter, whom the stalker had called Oganessian, suddenly stood up and brought himself to his full height. Artyom lifted his eyes to him with indifference.
"Well, it's time for me. Take care,"
he said, taking his leave. The rest dully looked at their comrade, not answering. Only the stalker nodded at him. Oganessian approached the edge, and unhesitatingly stepped forward. He didn't even scream, but from below was heard an unpleasant sound, a combination of a splash and a hungry rumbling.
"It calls,"
Ullman said in a sing-song voice and also began to get up. Artyom was spellbound.
"I think you won't worm yourself into me."
He got stuck on the word "I," and now he simply repeated it, not even noticing that he was speaking aloud.
I.
Then he strongly, irresistibly wanted to look down in order to understand whether the heaving mass there was as deformed as it had appeared to him at first. But had he suddenly been wrong about it, recalling again the stars on the Kremlin towers, distant and beckoning? And here the small Oleg sprang lightly to his feet, and taking a short run, threw himself down with a happy laugh. The living quagmire below chomped quietly, receiving the boy's body. Artyom understood that he envied him, and also intended to follow. But several seconds later, as the mass closed over Oleg's head, perhaps at that very moment when it had taken his life from him, his father screamed and regained consciousness. Breathing heavily and exhaustedly, looking from side to side, Anton lifted himself and set about shaking the others, demanding an answer from them.
"Where is he? What happened to him? Where is my son? Where is Oleg? Oleg! Oleg!"
Little by little, the faces of the fighters began to regain intelligence. Even Artyom began to become conscious. He was no longer certain what he really had seen as Oleg jumped into the seething mass. Therefore he didn't answer, just tried to calm Anton, who, it seemed, felt in a mysterious way that what had happened was irrevocable. And then his hysterics broke into the numbness felt by Artyom and in Melnik and the others. His agitation and his baleful despair were transferred to them, and the unseen hand firmly grasping their consciousness was yanked away. The stalker made several test shots at the bubbling mass, but with no success. Then he told the fighter armed with the flamethrower to remove the backpack with the fuel from his shoulders and, when told to, toss it as far as possible from the train. Having ordered two others to direct their flashlights on the spot where the backpack would fall, he prepared to fire and give the go-ahead. Spinning in place, the fighter hurled the backpack and almost flew right after it himself, barely managing to hold on to the edge of the roof. The backpack flew into the air and began to fall about 15 meters from the train.
"Get down."
Melnik waited until it touched the pulsing, oily surface and squeezed the trigger. Artyom watched the backpack's flight while stretched out on the roof. As soon as the shot rang out, he hid his face in the fold of his elbow and grasped the cold armor with all his might. The explosion was powerful. Artyom nearly flew off the roof as the train rocked. A dirty orange glow of blazing fuel splashing along the platform reached his blinking eyes. Nothing happened for a minute. The squelching and chomping of the quagmire did not weaken, and Artyom was already preparing for it to recover from the annoying unpleasantness and begin to envelop his mind again. But instead, the noise began gradually to move further away.
"It's leaving! It's leaving!"
Ullman bellowed right beside his ear. Artyom lifted his head. In the light of the flashlights, he could clearly see that the mass, which recently had occupied nearly the whole huge hall, was shrinking and retreating, returning to the escalator.
"Hurry!"
Melnick jumped to his feet.
"As soon as it slides down, everyone behind me, right to that tunnel!"
Artyom was surprised how Melnick could be so certain, but he wasn't about to ask, having put the Stalker's previous indecisiveness down to whatever had been controlling his mind. Now the Stalker was transformed. He was again the sober, decisive commander who did not put up with any argument. Not only was there no time to think about it, but he didn't even want to. The only thing that now occupied Artyom was how to get out of this damned station as soon as possible, before the strange being that dwelled in the Kremlin's basements recovered its wits and returned in order to consume them. The station no longer seemed marvelous and beautiful to him. Now everything here was hostile and repulsive. Even the workers and peasants looked down in outrage from its wall panels. They still smiled, but it was strained and sickly sweet. Having jumped pell-mell to the platform, they tore to the opposite end of the station. Anton had come too completely and ran as fast as the others, so that now nothing was delaying the party. After 20 minutes of mad racing through the black tunnel, Artyom began to gasp, and even the others had begun to tire. The Stalker allowed them to slow to a quick march.
"Where are we going?"
Artyom asked, overtaking Melnick.
"I think right now we are beneath Tverskaya. We should exit soon towards Mayakovskaya. We'll sort it out there."
"But how did you know which tunnel to enter?"
Artyom was curious.
"It was shown on the map we found at Genstab, but I only recalled that at the last moment."
As they arrived at the station, everything flew from their heads. Artyom pondered. Had his delight with the Kremlin station, with the pictures and the sculptures and its space and magnitude, come to nothing? Or was it some trickery, evoked by the terrible entity lurking in the Kremlin? Then he remembered the disgust and fear that the station had inspired in him when the drug had dissipated, and he began to doubt that these were his real feelings. Maybe the doodlebug forced them to feel an irresistible desire to run from there at breakneck speed when they caused it pain. Artyom was no longer sure of his true feelings. Did a monstrous creation of his mind release him, or did it continue to dictate thoughts to him and inspire his emotional experiences? At what moment did Artyom fall under its hypnotic influence? And was he sometimes free to make his own choices? And could his choice ever be free? Artyom again recalled the meeting with the two strange residents of Polyanka. He glanced back. Anton was walking 2 paces behind him. He no longer badgered anyone about what happened to his son. Someone had already told him. His face had hardened and gone dead. His gaze was turned inward. Did Anton understand that they were only a step away from rescuing the boy, that his death had become a ridiculous accident? But it had brought the others through. Accident or victim.
"You know, we all most likely were saved only thanks to Oleg. It is because of him that you regained consciousness," he said to Anton, not specifying how this had come about.
"Yes,"
Anton agreed indifferently.
"He told us that you served in the rocket forces, strategic."
"Tactical,"
Anton replied.
"The Tochka and the Iskander."
"And multiple fire systems, Smerch, Uragan."
Having held back a little, the Stalker, who had been listening to their conversation, asked,
"I can operate those too. I was a career soldier, and they taught it to us, and everyone was interested in it. Everyone wanted to try it, until I saw what it led to."
There was not the smallest sign of interest in his voice, and there was no uneasiness regarding the fact that his secret was known to strangers. His answers were short, mechanical. Melnick, nodding again, moved away from them, going on ahead.
"We need your help very much," Artyom said, carefully testing the waters. "Understand we have terrible things happening at Fedienka," he began, and he immediately stopped short. After what he had seen in the last 24 hours,
What happened at Vedienka, however awful, didn't seem like anything exceptional, capable of overwhelming the Metro and finally destroying man as a biological species. Artyom considered this thought and reminded himself that it could be coming from the strange entity.
We have some creatures getting through from the surface,
he continued, having collected his thoughts. But Anton stopped him with a gesture.
Just say what has to be done and I will do it,
he uttered colorlessly.
I have the time now. How can I return home without my son?
Artyom nodded nervously and walked away from the man, leaving him along with his thoughts. Now he felt unclean, seeking help from a man who had just lost a child. He had been deprived of him through his, Artyom's, fault. He caught up with the stalker again. Melnik was clearly in a good mood. Having left the party stretched out behind him, he was humming something to himself and seeing Artyom smiled at him. Listening to the melody Melnik was trying to reproduce, Artyom recognized that very song about the sacred war they'd been singing on the roof of the train.
You know, at first I decided this is the song for our war with the Dark Ones, he said, and then I understood that it is about fascists. Who composed it? The communists from the Red Line?
This song is already about 100 years old, if not 150.
Melnik shook his head.
They composed it first for one war, then adapted it for another. It's good that it is suitable for any war. As long as man is alive, he will always deem himself to be the light of the world, and consider his enemies as the darkness. And they will be thinking like that on both sides of the front.
Artyom added to himself, whatever it means.
His mind again flashed to the Dark Ones. Maybe it means that people, let's say the Vedienka inhabitants, are the evil and darkness for them.
Artyom thought better of it, and forbade himself to think of the Dark Ones as ordinary enemies. If one opened the door for them only halfway, nothing would hold them back.
So, you were saying about this song that it is eternal.
Melnik unexpectedly spoke.
That dawned on me too. In our country, all eras are much the same. Take people. You won't change them in any way. There are stubborn as mules. So it would seem the end of the world is already at hand, and you cannot go outside without an anti-radiation suit, and every kind of trash that earlier you only saw at the cinema has multiplied. No, you don't impress them. They're the same. Sometimes it seems to me that nothing has ever changed. Well, I visited the Kremlin today.
He smiled wryly,
and I was thinking, there's not even anything new there. I'm not even certain when they hit us with this crap, 30 years ago or 300.
Were there really such weapons 300 years ago?
Artyom was doubtful, but the stalker didn't reply. They'd seen 2 or 3 depictions of the great worm on the floor, but there had been no sign of the savages themselves. The first drawing had put the fighters on their guard, and they'd regrouped in such a way that it was easier to defend themselves, but the tension had dissipated after they'd encountered the third drawing.
They weren't jabbering nonsense. Today was a holy day and they stay at the stations and don't go into the tunnels,
Ullman noted with relief. Something else occupied the stalker. By his calculations, the missile unit was very close by. Checking the hand-drawn map every minute, he absent-mindedly repeated,
somewhere here. Isn't this it? No, that corner. But where is the pressurized gate? We ought to be approaching it already.
Finally, they stopped at a fork. To the left was a dead end with a grill, at the end of which they could see the remains of a pressurized gate, and to the right, as far as the light of the flashlight could reach, there was a straight tunnel.
That's it, Melnik determined. We're there. Everything tallies with the map. There, behind the grill, the tunnel has collapsed like a park pobjedi. And that must be the passage into which they took Tretiak. So,
illuminating the map with his pocket flashlight, he thought aloud,
the line goes directly from this fork to the division and this one to the Kremlin. We came from there, right?
Then he climbed behind the grill with Ullman, and they wandered around the dead end for about 10 minutes, inspecting the walls and ceiling with the flashlight.
Okay, there's a passage in the floor this time, a round sort of top similar to a sewer manhole,
the returning stalker reported.
Everyone, we are there. Take a break.
As soon as everyone had removed their rucksacks and had sprawled out on the ground, something strange happened to Artyom. Despite the awkward position, he fell asleep instantly. Either the fatigue accumulated in the last 24 hours had taken its toll, or the poison from the paralyzing needle was producing some side effects. Artyom again saw himself asleep in the tent at Fedyenche. As in his earlier dream, it was gloomy and abandoned at the station. Artyom knew beforehand what would happen to him now. Already accustomed to saying hello to the little girl who was playing, he didn't ask her about anything, heading instead directly toward the tracks. The distant cries and entreaties for mercy didn't frighten him. He knew that he was seeing the unwelcome dream again for another reason, one that was concealed in the tunnels. He was supposed to uncover the nature of the threat, reconnoiter the situation, and report about it to his allies from the south. But as soon as he was shrouded in the darkness of the tunnel, his confidence in himself and in the fact that he knew why he was here and how he had to go on vaporized. He was as frightened as when he went beyond the limits of the station alone for the first time. And exactly as then, it wasn't the darkness itself nor the rustle of the tunnels that scared him, but the unknown, the inability to foretell what danger the next 100 meters of the line concealed. Vaguely recalling how he had behaved in previous dreams, he decided not to give in to fear this time, but to go forward, until he met the one who was concealed in the dark, waiting for him. Someone was coming towards him. Not hurrying as he was, not walking with his cowardly, slinking short steps, but with a confident, heavy tread. Artyom stopped in his tracks, catching his breath. The other one also stopped. Artyom promised himself that he wouldn't run this time regardless of what happened. When, judging by the sound, only about 3 meters of darkness separated them, Artyom's knees shook, but somehow he found the strength to make one more step. But feeling a light flutter of the air on his face as someone approached, Artyom couldn't bear it. Flinging out a hand, he pushed the unseen being away and fled. This time he didn't stumble, and he ran for an intolerably long time, an hour or two, but there was no trace of his home station. There were no stations at all, nothing at all, only an endless dark tunnel, and this proved to be even more terrible.
"Hey, that's enough of a nap, you'll sleep through the meeting," Ullman pushed him on the shoulder.
Artyom roused himself and looked guiltily at the others. It appeared that he had dropped off for only a few minutes. They were all sitting in a circle. In the center was Melnik with the map, pointing and explaining.
"Well," he said, "it's about 20 kilometers to our destination. If we keep up a good pace and nothing gets in our way, it's possible to make it in half a day. The military unit is located on the surface, but there is a bunker under it and the tunnel leads to it. However, there's no time to think about it. We have to split up."
He looked at Artyom.
"Are you up? You are returning to the metro. I will appoint Ullman to look after you," he said. "The others and I are going to the missile division."
Artyom was on the verge of opening his mouth, intending to protest, but the stalker stopped him with an impatient gesture. Leaning towards the heap of rucksacks, Melnik started to distribute the supplies.
"You take 2 protective suits. We have 4 left, and we don't know what it will be like there. There's 1 radio for you and 1 for us. Now the instructions. Go to Prospect Mir. They are waiting for you there. I have sent some messengers."
He looked at his wristwatch.
"In exactly 12 hours, go up to the surface and look for our signal. If everything is okay and we are on the air, we'll move to the next stage of the operation. Your mission is to find the best way to the botanical gardens and then to get up high in order to help us direct and correct the fire. The Smirch has a limited destruction area, and we don't know how many missiles are still there, and the gardens aren't small. Don't worry," he said to Artyom. "Ullman will be doing it all. You are there as company. We have use for you too, of course. You know what these dark ones look like. The Ostankino Tower is very suitable for guidance. It's wider in the middle. There was a restaurant there. They served tiny sandwiches with caviar there at prices that were out of sight. But people didn't go there because of them, but for the view of Moscow. The botanical gardens can be seen clearly from there. Try to get to the tower. If you can't get to the tower, there is a multi-story building alongside, sort of white, shaped like the letter P, and almost uninhabited. So, there is a map of Moscow for you, and this one is for us. It's a shambles there around the squares. You simply look and communicate. The rest, follow us. It's nothing too complex," he assured them. "Questions?"
"And if they don't have a nest there?" Artyom asked.
"Well, we can't do the impossible.
The stalker slapped his palm on the map.
And I have a surprise here for you,
he added, winking at Artyom. Reaching into his backpack, Melnik took out a white polyethylene bag with a worn colored picture on the side. Artyom looked inside and took out the worn passport and the children's book with the cherished photograph that he had found in the neglected apartment at Kalininsky. Having raced after Oleg, he had left his treasures at Kievskaya, and Melnik had gone to the trouble to collect them and carry them with him all this time. Olman, sitting alongside, looked at Artyom with a puzzled look, then at the stalker.
Personal things,
Melnik said, smiling. Artyom wanted to thank him, but the stalker had already got up from his seat and was giving orders to the fighters going with him. Artyom went up to Anton, who was absorbed in his own thoughts.
Good luck.
Artyom extended his hand to the lookout. Anton silently nodded, putting his rucksack onto his back. His eyes were totally empty.
Well, that's all. We won't say goodbye. Note the time,
Melnik said. He turned, and without saying another word, was off. Chapter 19, The Final Battle. Having moved the heavy cast-iron lid of the closed manhole aside, they began their descent. The narrow vertical shaft was composed of concrete rings, from each of which jutted a metal bracket. As soon as they were left alone, Ullman changed. He spoke to Artyom in short monosyllabic phrases, mainly giving orders or admonishing him. As soon as the lid of the hatch had been removed, he ordered Artyom to put out the flashlight, and putting on the night vision instrument, dived inside first. Artyom had to crawl down, holding on to the brackets. He didn't really understand what all these precautions were for, as after the Kremlin, they hadn't encountered any danger along the way. Finally, Artyom decided that the stalker had given Ullman special instructions, and having been left without a commander, he was enthusiastically filling the role himself. Ullman smacked Artyom on the foot, giving the sign to stop. Artyom obediently froze, waiting until the other man explained to him what was happening. But instead of explanations, a soft thump was heard from below. It was Ullman jumping to the floor. A few seconds later, Artyom heard muffled gunshots.
You can come down,
his partner said to Artyom in a loud whisper, and a light came on. When the brackets ended, he released his hands and dropped about 2 meters, landing on a cement floor. Lifting himself up, he dusted off his hands and looked around. They were in a short corridor, about 15 paces long. The opening of the manhole yawned above them in the ceiling. There was another hatch just like it in the floor, with the very same cast-iron grooved cover. Beside it, in a pool of blood, lay a dead savage, face downwards, squeezing his blowpipe tight in his hand even after death.
He was guarding the passage,
Ullman replied quietly at Artyom's questioning glance.
But he had fallen asleep. Most likely he didn't expect anyone to crawl in from this side. He had put his ear to the hatch and dropped off.
You killed him? What, while he was sleeping?
Artyom asked.
So what? It wasn't a fair fight,
Ullman sniffed.
If nothing else, now he'll know not to sleep on duty. Anyway, he was a bad person. He wasn't observing their holiday. He was told not to go into the tunnels.
Dragging the body to the side, Ullman opened the hatch and again put out his flashlight. This time the shaft was extremely short and led to an office filled with trash. A mountain of metal plates, gears, springs, and nickel-plated handrails, enough parts for a whole coach, completely hid the manhole from prying eyes. They were heaped on top of each other in disarray, right up to the ceiling, and stayed there only by some kind of miracle. There was a narrow passage between this pile and the wall, but getting through it without touching and bringing a whole mountain of metal down was almost impossible. A door buried in dirt up to its middle led from the office to an unusual square tunnel. A line from the left. Either there was an obstruction, or they had stopped laying the track for some reason. To the right, there was a standard tunnel, round and wide. It seemed as if there was a border between 2 intertwined subterranean worlds here. Even breathing was different. The air was damp, but not so ghastly and stagnant as in the secret D6 passages. They weren't sure where to go. They decided not to move out at random, as there was a frontier post of the Fourth Reich located on this line. Judging by the map, it was only about 20 minutes from Mayakovskaya to Chekhovskaya. Digging into the bag with his things, Artyom found the bloodied map he had got from Daniel, and worked out the true direction from it. Less than 5 minutes later, they reached Mayakovskaya. Sitting down on a bench, Ullman took the heavy helmet off his head with a sigh of relief, wiped his red, damp face with a sleeve, and ran his fingers through his dark, blonde crew cut. Despite his powerful frame and having the habits of an old tunnel wolf, Ullman, it seemed, was only slightly older than Artyom. While they were looking for somewhere to buy food, Artyom was able to inspect the station. He no longer knew how much time had passed since his last meal, but his aching stomach was no laughing matter. Ullman had no supplies on him. They had left in a hurry and brought only what was necessary. Mayakovskaya resembled Kievskaya. It was just a shadow of the once elegant and airy station. In this half of the ruined station, people huddled in ragged tents or out on the platform. The walls and ceiling were covered with damp patches and trickling water. There was one small campfire for the whole station, but no fuel. The inhabitants talked among themselves quietly, as if at the bedside of a dying man. However, there was a shop even here, a patched-up three-man tent with a folding table displayed at the entrance. The selection was modest. Skinned rat carcasses, dried up and shrunken mushrooms, procured here God knows when, and even uncut squares of moss. A price tag lay proudly next to each item. A piece of newsprint with carefully handwritten numbers. There were almost no shoppers except them, only an undernourished stooped woman holding a small boy by the hand. The child was pulling towards a rat lying on the counter, but his mother admonished him.
"Don't touch. We've already eaten meat this week."
The boy obeyed, but he didn't forget about the carcass for long. As soon as the mother turned away, he once more tried to reach for the dead animal.
"Kolka, what did I tell you? If you are bad, the demons will come out of the tunnels to get you. Sashka didn't obey his mommy and they took him."
The woman scolded him, succeeding at the last moment to pull him away from the counter. Artyom and Ullman couldn't make up their minds. Artyom began to think that he could survive until they got to Prospekt Mir, where the mushrooms would at least be fresher.
"Some rat, perhaps? We fry them in front of the customer," the shop's bald owner said with some dignity. "Certificate of quality," he added enigmatically.
"Thanks, I've already eaten." Ullman hastened to turn him down.
"Artyom, what do you want? I wouldn't take the moss. World War IV will start in your gut from it."
The woman looked at him with disapproval. In her hand were only 2 cartridges, which, judging by the prices, was just enough for the moss. Noting that Artyom was looking at her modest capital, the woman hid her fist behind her back.
"Nothing here,"
she snarled spitefully.
"If you don't intend to buy anything, get lost."
"We're not all millionaires. What are you staring at?"
Artyom wanted to answer, but he was carried away by the sight of her son. The boy was very similar to Oleg. He had the same colorless, fragile hair, reddish eyes, and turned-up nose. The boy put his thumb in his mouth and smiled shyly at Artyom, looking at him a bit sullenly. Artyom felt as if his lips were spreading into a smile in spite of himself, and his eyes were swelling with tears. The woman intercepted his glance and flew into a rage.
"Damned perverts!"
she screeched, her eyes glaring.
"Let's go home, Kolienka!"
She pulled the boy by the hand.
"Wait, stop for a minute."
Artyom pressed several shells out of the reserve clip of his machine gun, and catching up to the woman, gave them to her.
"Here, these are for you, for your Kolya."
She looked at him with distrust, then her mouth twisted scornfully.
"Just what do you think you can get for 5 cartridges? That he'll be your child?"
Artyom didn't immediately understand what she had in mind. Finally, it came to him, and he was on the verge of opening his mouth to start making excuses. But he wasn't able to utter a thing, and he just stood there staring blankly. The woman, satisfied with the effect she had produced, replaced her rage with mercy.
"Agreed, certainly. 20 cartridges for 30 minutes.
Stunned, Artyom shook his head, turned, and nearly took off running.
"Jerk! Okay, give me 15!
The woman cried after him. Ullman was still standing there, discussing something with the seller.
"Well, what about the rats? Haven't you made up your mind?"
The owner of the tent inquired courteously, having seen the returning Artyom,
A little bit more and she'll start bargaining with me.
Artyom understood. Pulling Ullman behind him, he hurried from the godforsaken station.
Where are we going in such a hurry?
The fighter asked when they were walking through the tunnel in the direction of Bieloruskaya. While trying to cope with the lump rising in his throat, Artyom told him what had happened. His story did not especially impress Ullman.
So what? She has to live somehow, he responded. Why is such a life necessary at all?
Artyom's face convulsed.
Do you have any ideas?
Ullman shrugged his broad shoulders.
What's the sense of such a life? You cling to it, you endure all this filth, humiliation, you trade your children, stuff your face with moss, for what?
Artyom stopped short, recalling Hunter, who had been talking about the survival instinct, about the fact that one would fight like a wild animal for his life and the survival of others with all his might. Then, at the very beginning, his words had inflamed a hope and desire in Artyom to fight like that frog who had whipped the cream in the jar with its feet, turning it into butter. But now the words uttered by his stepfather for some reason seemed more reliable.
For what?
Ullman teased him.
Well, all right, young man, for what are you living?
Artyom regretted that he had got involved in this conversation. As a fighter, he had to give Ullman his due. He was superb, but as a companion he wasn't especially interesting, and Artyom could see it was useless to argue with him regarding the sense of life.
Well, personally, I am...
For what? He answered suddenly, not able to bear it.
Well, for what?
Ullman began to laugh.
For the rescue of mankind? Leave it, it's all nonsense. You aren't saving it, so it's someone else. Me, for example.
He shined the flashlight on his face so that Artyom could see him and made a heroic face. Artyom looked at him jealously but said nothing.
And then, the fighter continued, they all just cannot leave for it.
And what about you? Is life without meaning?
Artyom tried to ask the question ironically.
How is it without meaning? It makes sense for me, the same way as for everyone. And generally, searches for the meaning of life usually happen during puberty. But for you, it seems it's taken longer.
His tone was not offensive, but mischievous, so that Artyom wouldn't sulk. Inspired by his success, Ullman continued.
I remember when I was 17. I was trying to understand it all too. It passes. There is only one meaning in life, brother, to make and bring up children. But let them be tormented by the question, and answer it how they can. Well, that's the theory.
He smiled again.
And then just why are you coming with me? Are you risking your life? If you don't believe in rescuing mankind, then what?
Artyom asked after some time.
First, I was ordered to,
Ullman said severely.
Orders are not questioned. Second, it's not enough to make children, you have to raise them. And how will I grow them if your riffraff from Fedayenche eat them up?
Such self-confidence exuded from him, his strength and his words, that the picture of the world was so seductively simple and organized that Artyom no longer wanted to argue with him. On the other hand, he felt that the fighter was inspiring a confidence in him, too. As Melnik had said, the tunnel between Mayakovskaya and Bieloruskaya turned out to be peaceful. True, something was banging in the ventilation shafts, but they slipped past normal-sized rats a few times, and that reassured Artyom. The section was surprisingly short. They had not even been able to complete the argument when the lights of the station appeared ahead. Being close to Hansa had a profound influence on Bieloruskaya. It was immediately apparent that it was rather well protected. A blockhouse had been constructed 10 meters from the entrance. A light machine gun stood on sacks filled with dirt, and the guard detail consisted of 5 men. Checking their documents, and here the new passport came in handy, they asked them politely whether they were from the Reich. No, no, they assured Artyom, no one here has anything against the Reich. It was a trading station, observed full neutrality, and did not interfere in the conflicts between the powers, as the chief of the guard called Hansa, the Reich, and the Red Line. Before continuing their trip along the ring, Artyom and Ullman decided they could take a break and have a bite. Sitting in an affluent, even chic snack bar, Artyom obtained information about Bieloruskaya, as well as eating an excellent and inexpensive cutlet. A round-faced, fair-haired man sitting at the table opposite, who introduced himself as Leonid Petrovich, was tucking away an epic portion of bacon and eggs, and when his mouth was empty, he told them with pleasure about his station. Bieloruskaya survived because of the transit of pork and chicken. Huge and very successful enterprises were located beyond the ring, closer to Sokol and even to Voikoskaya, though the latter was dangerously close to the surface. Kilometers of tunnels and engineering lines had been converted to a huge livestock farm that fed all of Hansa and delivered goods both to the Fourth Reich and to the eternally half-starved Red Line. Moreover, the residents of Dynamo had inherited from their enterprising predecessors an aptitude for the tailor's trade. They sewed the pigskin jackets that Artyom had seen at Prospekt Mir. No external danger from this end of the Zamoskvoretskaya line existed, and in all the years of living in the metro, no one even once had put either Sokol, airport, or Dynam out of business. Hansa laid no claims to them, being satisfied by the ability to collect a duty from the transportation of the goods, and at the same time, they rendered them protection from the fascists and the Reds. Nearly all of the residents of Bieloruskaya were involved in business. Farmers from Sokol and tailors from Dynamo had the sense to make a profit from the wholesale deliveries. Bringing a batch of hogs or live chickens on handcars and trams pulled by men, the people from that side, as they call them here, unloaded their belongings. For these purposes, special cranes even had been installed on the platforms, settled up their accounts, and left for home. Life bustled at the station. The resolute traders at Bieloruskaya, they were called managers for some reason, drifted from the terminal, the unloading locations, to warehouses, jingling bags with cartridges, and dispensing instructions to sinewy loaders. Small carts on well-lubricated wheels, laden with boxes and bundles, rolled noiselessly towards rows of counters, or to the ring boundary line, from where Hansa buyers took the merchandise, or to the opposite edge of the platform, where Reich emissaries awaited the unloading of their orders. There were quite a few fascists here, but not the ordinary ones, mainly officers. However, they behaved themselves. They were a little arrogant, but within the bounds of decency. They looked with hostility at the swarthy, dark-haired men, of whom there were enough among the local tradesmen and loaders, but they didn't try to impose their beliefs and laws.
"And we have banks here too, you know. Many of them from the Reich come to us supposedly for goods, but really they come to invest their savings,"
his companion shared with Artyom.
"I doubt they will touch us. We are like Switzerland for them,"
he added incomprehensibly.
"You have it good here," Artyom noted politely.
"It's not just us. It's all about Bieloruskaya. So where are you from?"
Leonid Petrovich finally asked out of respect. Ullman pretended that all his attention was on his cutlet and he had not heard the question.
"I'm from Fedyenka," Artyom replied, glancing at him.
"What do you say? How terrible."
Leonid Petrovich even put down his knife and fork.
"They say things are really bad there. I heard they are hanging on by a thread. Half the people have died. Is it true?"
A lump stuck in Artyom's throat. For better or for worse, he had to reach Fedyenka, see his own kind, perhaps for the last time. How had he been able to waste valuable time eating? Moving the plate away, he asked for the bill, and, despite Ullman's protests, pulled him along with him, past the counters with meat and clothing in the openings of the arches, past the piles of merchandise, past the bartering peddlers, bustling loaders, the sedately strolling fascist officers, towards the crossing to the ring line. Over the entrance hung a white cloth with a brown circle in the middle. Two machine gunners in the familiar grey camouflage checked their documents and inspected their things. Artyom had not succeeded in getting through to the Hansa territory with such ease before. Ullman, still chewing a piece of cutlet, dug into his pocket and presented an unknown type of ID to the border guards. They silently moved away a section of the barrier, allowing them in.
"What kind of pass is that?" Artyom was curious.
"So, the award booklet for the medal for service to the fatherland,"
Ullman laughed it off.
"Everyone is indebted to our colonel."
The crossing to the ring was a strange mixture of fortress and warehouses. The second Hansa border began beyond the footbridges over the tracks. Real, we doubts, had been erected there with machine guns and even a flamethrower. And further away, next to a memorial, a bronze-bearded guy with a machine gun, a frail girl and a pensive lad with weapons, most likely the founders of Bieloruskaya, or heroes of a battle with mutants, Artyom thought, a whole garrison of not less than 20 soldiers was deployed.
This is because of the Reich,
Ullman explained to Artyom.
It's like this with the fascists. Trust but verify. They didn't touch Switzerland, of course, but they subjugated France.
I have gaps in my knowledge of history, Artyom acknowledged with embarrassment. My stepfather couldn't find a 10th grade textbook, though I have read a little about ancient Greece.
An endless chain of loaders with bundles on their shoulders trailed past the soldiers like ants. The movement was well organized. The bearers descended on one escalator and they came up unladen on the other. A third was intended for the remaining passers-by. Below sat a machine gunner in a glass booth, watching the escalator. He checked Artyom and Ullman's documents again and issued them papers with the stamp, temporary registration, in transit, and the date. This station was also named Bieloruskaya, but the difference from its radial twin was striking. They were like twins separated at birth, one of whom ended up in a royal family, and the other who was adopted and grew up poor. All the prosperity of that first Bieloruskaya faded in comparison with the ring station. It gleamed with shining white walls, fascinated with intricate stucco work on the ceiling, and dazzled with neon lamps of which only three were burning in all the station, but even their light was more than enough. The loaders on the platform were divided into two parts. One group walked to the tracks through arches on the left, the other to the right, casting off their bundles into piles and returning at a run for new ones. Two stops had been made at the tracks, for merchandise, where a small crane had been installed, and for passengers, where a ticket office stood. Once every 15 or 20 minutes, a cargo handcar went past the station. They were outfitted with a peculiar body, board planking on which they had loaded boxes and bundles. Besides the 3 or 4 men who stood at the handles of the handcar, there also was a guard on each. The passenger handcars arrived more rarely. Artyom and Ullman had to wait more than 40 minutes. As the ticket collector explained to them, the passenger handcars waited until enough people had gathered so as not to send the workers on errands for no reason. The fact that somewhere in the metro it was still possible to buy a ticket, a cartridge for each stage, and pass from station to station as before completely fascinated Artyom. He even forgot about all his problems for a while and simply stood and observed the loading of the merchandise. It showed him how fine life in the metro must have been earlier, when huge, sparkling trains, not manual handcars, moved along the tracks.
"That's your carrier coming,"
the ticket collector announced, and he began to ring a small bell. A large handcar, to which was attached a tram with wooden benches, rolled to a stop. Having presented their tickets, they sat down on unoccupied seats. After waiting another few minutes for tardy passengers, the trolley moved on. Half the benches were situated so that the passengers were sitting facing forward and half facing to the rear. Artyom had got a seat facing backwards, and Ullman was sitting in the remaining seat with his back to him.
"Why are the seats arranged so strangely, in different directions?"
Artyom asked of his neighbor, a hale old woman of about 60 years old who was wearing a woolen shawl riddled with holes.
"It's uncomfortable, you know."
She threw up her hands.
"And what? Would you leave the tunnel running wild? You young people are thoughtless. Didn't you hear what happened over there the other day? Well, such a rat!"
The old woman gestured in dismay.
"Jumped out of an interline and dragged away a passenger!"
"It wasn't a rat,"
a man in a quilted jacket interrupted, turning round.
"It was a mutant. They have a lot of mutants running about at Kurskaya."
"And I say a rat. Nina Prokoyevna, my neighbor, told me. Do you think I don't know?"
The old woman was indignant. They argued for a long time, but Artyom was no longer listening to their conversation. His thoughts once again had turned to Vedienka. He had already decided that before he went up to the surface to set out for the Ostankino Tower with Ullman, he would definitely try to get through to his home station. He still didn't know how he would convince his partner, but he had a bad feeling that this might be his last chance to see his home and friends. And he couldn't ignore it. Who knew what would happen later? Though the stalker had said that there was nothing complicated about their task, Artyom didn't really believe that he would be meeting him any time again. However, before starting his own, perhaps final climb up, he had to at least return to Vedienka for a little while. How it sounded. Vedienka. Melodic. Endearing.
I could listen and listen to it, Artyom thought. Had his casual acquaintance at Bieloruskaya really been speaking the truth? Was the station really on the point of falling to the onslaught of the Dark Ones? Were half its defenders already dead? How long had he been absent? 2 weeks? 3? He closed his eyes, trying to imagine his beloved arches, the elegant but reserved lines of the domes, the delicate forging of the copper ventilation grids between them and rows of tents in the hall. The handcar gently swayed in time to the lulling chatter of the wheels, and Artyom didn't notice that it was putting him to sleep. He was dreaming about Vedienka again. Nothing surprised him anymore. He wasn't listening and not trying to understand. The goal of his dream was not at the station, but in the tunnel. Leaving the tent, Artyom went right to the tracks, jumped down and headed south towards the botanical gardens. The darkness no longer frightened him, but something else did. The forthcoming meeting in the tunnel. Who awaited him there? What was the point of it? Why did his courage always fail him in the end? His twin finally appeared in the depths of the tunnel. Soft, confident steps gradually approached, as before, and Artyom felt his nerve failing. However, this time he comported himself better. His knees shook, but he was able to control himself and wait until he came right up to the unseen creature. He was covered in a cold, sticky sweat, but did not break into a run when the light ripple of the air told him that the mysterious being was just a few centimeters from his face.
"Don't run. Look into the eyes of your fate,"
a dry, rustling voice whispered into his ear. And here Artyom recalled, and just how had he been able to forget about it in his past nightmares, that he had a lighter in his pocket. Groping for it, he struck the flint, preparing to see who was speaking to him, and he immediately went numb, feeling only that his feet were taking root in the ground. A Dark One stood next to him, not moving. Its dark eyes were without pupils and wide open, searching for his glance. Artyom cried as loudly as he could.
"Damnation!"
The old woman was holding her hand to her heart, breathing heavily. "How you frightened me, you tyrant!"
"Please forgive him, he's with me and he's nervous," Ullman said, turning around.
"Just what did you see there that you shouted out?"
The old woman shot him a curious glance from beneath half-closed, swollen eyelids.
"It was a dream. I had a nightmare," Artyom answered. "Excuse me."
"A dream? Well, you young people are impressionable."
She again started moaning and bickering. Actually, Artyom had slept for a rather long time. He even had slept through the stop at Novoslobodskaya. But he didn't have time to remember what he had understood at the end of his nightmare as the passenger handcar arrived at Prospekt Mir. The situation here was strikingly different from the satisfying prosperity of Bieloruskaya. There was no business recovery at Prospekt Mir, not even a sign of it, but on the other hand, one immediately noticed a large number of military personnel. Spetsnaz and officers with the chevrons of the engineering troops. From the other edge of the platform on the track stood several guarded cargo motorized trolleys with mysterious boxes covered with tarpaulins. In the hall, nearly 50 poorly dressed people with huge trunks were sitting right on the floor, looking round hopelessly.
"What's going on here?" Artyom asked Ullman.
"It's not what's happening here, it's what you have going on at Vidyenka," the fighter replied. "It's obvious they intend to blow up the tunnels. If the Dark Ones crawl through from Prospekt Mir, Hansa will have to answer for it. Most likely they are getting ready for a preemptive strike."
While they were crossing to the Kalushka-Rishkaya line, Artyom grew convinced that Ullman's guess was most likely correct. The Hansa Spetsnaz was also active at a radial station where it wasn't supposed to be. Both entrances to the tunnels leading to the north towards Vedienka and the botanical gardens were fenced off. Someone had constructed some makeshift blockhouses here where the Hansa border guards were on duty. There were no visitors in the marketplace. Almost half the stands were empty, and people whispered nervously as if inevitable misfortune was looming over the station. Several dozen people were crowded into one corner, whole families with bundles and bags.
A chain had been strung around a table with the sign Refugee Registration.
Wait for me here. I'll go find our man.
Old man left him at the shopping area and disappeared. But Artyom had a few things he wanted to do himself. Climbing down onto the rails, he went up to a blockhouse and started talking with a sullen border guard.
Can one still get to Vedienka? We are still letting them through, but I don't advise going there,
the guard answered.
Haven't you heard what's happening there? Some kind of vampires are getting in, so many that they can't be stopped. They've taken over nearly the whole station. Obviously, it's really hot there. If our miserly leadership had decided to let them have some free ammo, if only to hold them off till tomorrow...
What's happening tomorrow?
Tomorrow we're going to blow everything to hell. We are placing dynamite 300 meters from Prospect in both tunnels, and everything will be just a fond memory.
But why don't you just help them? Certainly Hansa has the power.
I told you. The vampires there, it's swarming with them. There's not enough backup.
But what about the people from Rishkaya and from Vedeyanha itself? Artyom couldn't believe his ears.
We alerted them several days ago. They're trickling in. Hansa is taking them. We aren't animals. But they had better hurry. When the time runs out, it's so long. So, you should try to get there and back as soon as possible. What do you have there, business, family?
All of it, Artyom replied, and the border guard nodded knowingly. Ullman was standing in the arch, quietly speaking with a tall young man and a stern man in a machinist's coat, and with the full regalia of the station chief.
The vehicle is up above and the tank is full. In any event, I still have a radio and protective suits, and another Pechenyek and a Dragunov sniper rifle.
The youth pointed at two large black bags.
We can go up at any time. When do you need us up there?
We'll be monitoring the signal every 8 hours. We should already be in position by then, Ullman answered. Is the pressurized gate working?
He addressed the chief.
It's okay,
the chief confirmed.
When you give the word, only we'll have to drive off the people so they aren't frightened. That's all I have. So we'll rest for about 5 hours or so and then full speed ahead,
Ullman summed up.
So, Artyom, lights out?
I can't, Artyom told him, pulling his partner aside. I have to get back to Vedienche, to say goodbye and just to look around. You are right, they will be blowing up all the tunnels from Prospect Mir. Even if we come back alive from there, I won't see my station anymore. I have to, honestly.
Listen, if you are just afraid of going up to your dark ones, just say so.
Old man nearly started, but on seeing Artyom's look, he stopped short.
It was a joke. Excuse me.
Honest, I have to, Artyom repeated. He couldn't explain his feeling, but he knew that he had to get to Vedienche at any cost.
Well, if you have to, then you have to, the fighter replied, embarrassed. You won't have time to get back, especially if you intend to say goodbye to someone there. Here's what we'll do. We'll ride from here along Prospect Mir in the vehicle with Pashka. That's him with the cases. We had intended to go directly to the tower earlier, but we can take a detour and run by the old entrance to the Vedienha Metro. Everything new has been turned upside down. Your people have to know that. We'll wait for you there. In 5 hours and 50 minutes. Whoever doesn't make it is late. Did you get a suit? Do you have a watch? Here, take mine. I'll get one from Pashka.
He unfastened the metal bracelet. In 5 hours, 50 minutes. Artyom nodded, shook Ullman's hand, and raced towards the blockhouse. Seeing him again, the border guard shook his head.
And nothing else strange is happening in this crossing?
Artyom asked. Are you here about the pipes or what?
It's nothing. They patched them up. They say your head will spin when you are going by,
the border guard answered. Artyom thanked him with a nod, turned on his flashlight and walked into the tunnel. Different thoughts raced through his head for the first 10 minutes, about the danger of the crossing laying ahead, about the considered and reasonable way of life at Bieloruskaya, then about the carriers and real trains. But gradually the tunnel's darkness sucked these trivial thoughts, this confusion of flashing pictures and snatches of phrases from him. At first he grew calm, empty. Then he began to think about something else. His journey was coming to an end. Even Artyom could not say how long he had been away. Maybe 2 weeks had passed, perhaps more than a month. How simple, how short the trip had seemed to him when, sitting on the handcar at Alexeyevskaya, he had been looking at his old map in the light of the flashlight, trying to plan a route to Polis. An unknown world lay before him then, about which he knew nothing for certain. It had been possible to develop a route by considering only the length of the journey and not how it would change the traveler walking it. Life had turned out to be very different, confused and complex, mortally dangerous. Even casual companions sharing small segments of his trip with him had paid for it with their lives. Artyom remembered Oleg. "Everyone has his own predestination," Sergei Andreevich had told him at Polyanka. Could it have been that the terrible, nonsensical death spared other people and allowed them to continue their affairs? Artyom grew cold and uncomfortable. To accept such a proposition, to accept this sacrifice, meant that he had to believe that his journey could only be at the cost of somebody's life. Could it be that in order to fulfill his predestined fate, others had to be trampled, destroyed, crippled? Oleg, of course, had been too young to ask why he had been born, but if he had thought about it, he would hardly have agreed to a fate. The faces of Mikhail Porfirievich, Daniel, and Tretiak passed before his eyes. Why did they die? Why did Artyom himself survive? What gave him this capacity, this right? Artyom was sorry that Ullmann, who with one mocking remark could dispel his doubts, was not with him now. The difference between them was that the trip through the metro had forced Artyom to see the world as if through a multifaceted prism. But Ullmann's Spartan life had taught him to view things simply through the sight of a sniper's rifle. He didn't know which of the two of them was right, but Artyom no longer was able to believe that there can be only one single, true answer to every question. Generally in life, and especially in the metro, everything was unclear, changing, and relative. Kahn had explained this to him at first using the example of the station clock. If such a basis for perceiving the world as time turned out to be far-fetched and relative, then just what could be said about other indisputable views of life? All of it, from the voice of the pipe in the tunnel through which he was walking and the shining of the Kremlin stars to the eternal secrets of the human soul, had several explanations. And there were many answers to the question, why? The people Artyom had encountered, from the cannibals at Park Pyobedy to the fighters of the Che Guevara Brigade, knew how to answer it. All of them had their own answers, the sectarians and the Satanists, the fascists and the philosophers with the machine guns, like Kahn. It was for this reason that it was difficult for Artyom to choose and accept only one of them. Getting a new version of the answer every day, Artyom was unable to compel himself to believe what was true, because the next day another, no less precise and comprehensive one might arise. Whom should he believe? And in what? In the great worm, the cannibalistic god shaped like an electrified train and populating the barren, scorched earth with living beings, in the wrathful and jealous Jehovah, in his vainglorious reflection. Satan, in the victory of communism in the whole metro, in the supremacy of fair-haired men with turned-up noses over curly-haired, swarthy races. Something suggested to Artyom that there were no differences in any of it. Any faith served man only as a crutch supporting him. When Artyom was young, his stepfather's story about how a monkey took up a cane and became a man made him laugh. After that, apparently, the clever macaque no longer let the cane out of his hand because he couldn't straighten up. He understood why man needs this support. Without it, life would have become empty, like an abandoned tunnel. The desperate cry of the savage from Park Pobiedi when he realized that the great worm was only a contrivance of his people's priests still resonated in Artyom's ears. Artyom felt something similar, finding out that the unseen observers did not exist. But for him, repudiation of the observers, the snake, and other metro gods made life easier. Did that mean that he was stronger than the others? Artyom understood that was not true. The cane was in his hands, and he was supposed to become brave enough to recognize it.